Hello, everyone, and welcome to the plenary session of the inaugural Archive Space member meeting. I'm just going to read off here, so it might be a little dry at the very beginning. But at first, I'm going to introduce all four speakers at once, including myself, which is always a little awkward. And then we'll move on to the presentations. After the presentations, we should have ample time for what we hope will be a highly interactive question and answer session. So please feel free to ask your questions at the microphones once the presentations are over. Or you can also ask questions via Twitter if you use this hashtag. And I've only seen two tweets so far using this today, so this is, you know, encouragement to do that. You can also take this time while I do the introductions to the presenters to tweet as well if you'd like. So first up, we're going to hear from John Herbert. John is the Director of Digital Programs at Lyrisys. He has served as the head of digital ventures and program director for the Utah Digital Newspapers Program at the University of Utah. Prior to working at the University of Utah, John served in several technology and operations leadership positions at the American Express Traveler's Check Group. John holds a Master's of Business Administration from the University of Utah and a Bachelor of Arts in Computer Sciences and Mathematics from the University of Kansas. Next up will be Patrick Galligan. Patrick is an Archive Space super user. Patrick spends much of his time wrangling metadata, exploring new systems, training employees, writing documentation, preserving digital objects, and examining new and legacy data. And despite all of that, has also found time to watch a lot of Parks and Recreation, which you'll see a little bit about later. And again, yeah, sorry. Patrick also is has been basically in charge of implementing Archive Space at the Rockefeller Archive Center. And he also graduated from the University of Michigan School of Information. After Patrick, Mark Custer, that's me, I will come back up to the podium. And I'm a member of the Archive Space Committee at Yale University, which I'll be talking a little bit about, as well as a former member of the Archive Space Users Advisory Council. I have gained substantial experience with archival metadata management systems and practices by helping to implement Archivist Toolkit at three different institutions, East Carolina University, the Smithsonian, and the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library, which is where I'm currently at. And also, I'm a graduate of the School of Information Studies at Syracuse University. For our final talk, we'll hear from Melissa Wisner. Melissa is the Manager of Enterprise Systems and Programming Services at Yale University Library. For the past 9 years, Melissa has frequently served as a project manager for large-scale software implementations, and she has recently been integral in Yale's work to help standardize and centralize IT support for our Special Collections Department. Melissa's undergraduate background is in the humanities, despite being an IT professional, and she holds a master's in management information systems. So now, to get us started, I'll turn things over to John.
Thanks, Mark. Just as a bit more on my background, yes, I am from the University of Kansas. We have a fellow Jayhawk here in the room, Rock Chalk. So... And it's very rare that I get to one-up Robert, but he mentioned Fortune 500. I've got a Dow 30 company on Robert, so that's pretty rare. So, I am for the last few months the program director the director for digital services at Lyrisys. As Robert was explaining, we're a membership organization. 2,000 members, give or take. Archives, libraries, and museums are our core constituencies. And as the hand-raising was going on, the lines are blurring between them now, of course. And we have a range of services across all three constituencies. So in spite of that sort of breadth of the operations at Lyrisys, I'm going to focus on a narrow niche today. We're going to talk about, of course, not only just archive space, but archive space implementations. That's the theme of the panel today. And me is sort of in the lead-off role. I'm going to focus on smaller institutions, sort of the key decision points and things for you to think about as you might approach implementing the software, sort of high-level tasks. Okay, now, of course, as Angela and Brad and others and Robert mentioned, this is a membership community. I don't need to necessarily tell this group the benefits of joining the community, but of course there are many. You get access to the best of the open source software, I think, as sort of the theme in the introductory comments. Archive Space Community, I think, is a model. As I'm learning the open source space, what I see through Archive Space and the membership, the governance and the software, the platform, it's all very active. All the pieces are fitting together. It's a model. Most others aren't this effective, in my humble opinion. So you get the best of the open source, user documentation training we talked about. There's data migration. There's a couple of tools in place for Archon and ATK. Others are being developed. I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. And, of course, you can participate in the community. You can participate in the governance. You can help shape the future of the platform. So some of the things I'm just going to run through sort of quickly, the key decision points, software, servers, migration, theming, training, and support as you look at implementing the software. In fact, I don't want to hurt this laptop. In fact, we were talking, Mark and Patrick and I, one of the key things we've learned for the entire week is that you can actually access Mist online, right? We saw an icon on the desktop of this laptop, so it's important for us to know. Software. Okay. For a smaller institution, as you look at bringing on Archive Space, certainly our recommendation would be to start with the community-supported version of the platform. The benefits of that, of course, you stay on the straight upgrade path. And for a smaller institution, maybe doesn't have as many technological resources, is an important thing to consider. And unless you're going to release or develop your own release, don't fork the code. Develop plugins and, of course, attach them to the software. And be careful of those plugins if they're updating the database, because you can get astray off the upgrade path that way. There's a startup script to install software. It's available, of course. And just as an FYI, the public interface is turned on by default. The server setup, for the hardware side of this, the minimum system requirements are out there online. Of course, as with all softwares, the performance tuning is trial and error. You'll have to find your way through a little bit. MySQL needs to be used for the production. This is from my tech team, a recommendation. Don't use the demo database for your actual setup because it's difficult to migrate the data out of it. And, of course, you have to set up your security system certificates, SSL certificates, and domain names. Data migration, I was touched on this before. There are a couple of tools in place from the old gen systems, Archon and Archivist Toolkit. Those are in place. There's a little nuance with Archon. You've got to migrate it into aSpace version 1.0.4, and then from there, upgrade. So it's a little sort of extra step in the Archon migration. And I think there's, as Carol was talking about, there's more work being planned or at least put in the roadmap for more custom types of migrations. It's an important part of onboarding. Theming. At Lyrisys, we use plugins to do our clients' branding. Be careful that you don't overwrite the Archive Space views. And I think, as was mentioned, Angela was talking about, the public UI is being rewritten, so if you're customizing in there, be cautious about that because your work could get overwritten. And, of course, training. Certainly don't forget that. Depending on how big your shop is, you've got to get everybody trained. And, you know, the timing of the training and the depth of the training. And there is help from the Org Home as well as from Lyrisys if you would happen to be a hosting client around training. And some of the other members as well. Support. So if you're running your own shop, of course, you've got to monitor the system, not only get the hardware up and put the software on it, but you got to run it on a day-to-day basis. You got to monitor the system, understand uptime, keep it available. There's support issues, right? Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3 are the sort of basic user error, user training issues. Are there software bugs? Are there sort of major emergency sort of shutdowns? Those sorts of things. Who's going to address it? How quickly? How are you going to communicate with your users? You know, just the day-to-day operation of your system. You've got to figure out data backups. MySQL and Solr at a minimum. Those are the first bits. And of course, really, a backup is not any good unless you know how to recover from it, how to use it, right? So you've got to have a recovery plan with your data backups. Don't forget that. A lot of people take a backup and stick it on the shelf, but you might want to practice bringing that tape off the shelf and reloading it. Make sure you can rebuild from it. So that's a quick run through for me, and we're going to save questions till the end, right? Okay, I'm going to pitch it to Patrick. So.
Thanks, John. So it's Saturday afternoon after SA, so we're going to have some fun. So, start, give some context. The Rockefeller Archive Center is an independent operating foundation that preserves and makes available for research the archival collections of members of the Rockefeller family, also nonprofit organizations that they've started. We are at the very small level. We only have about 50 staff members total, but about 20 full-time archivists. On staff, and almost all of those work with ArchivesSpace now. We went live in December of 2014 after about a one full year process. And I'm just going to talk a little bit today about some challenges and successes we've had along the way, and hopefully give you an idea of what I'm sure a lot of you already know what you should be thinking about when implementing, but maybe where we as a small team ran into problems and what a lot of our time went into. I spent about 500 total hours in a year, and that was learning from the system completely from scratch all the way through adoption and essentially being the sole person responsible for it. There, our implementation team consisted of three people, my old manager, Sybil Schaefer, myself, and one of our sysadmins. And Sybil mainly directed my work, made sure I wasn't screwing anything up too much. Then the sysadmin set up our server for us. But other than that, I did everything else. So it's definitely possible in a small shop if you're working by yourself. So a little bit about our data to begin with. We have 14,000 name records, 8,200 subject records, 3,200 accession records, 11,000 resource records, and that's because we have library records in there, don't ask, and about 2,400 digital objects and growing at this point in time. I had very little experience with MySQL, had some Python experience, no way an expert, and you can learn on the job while you're going. And we were migrating from AT to ArchivesSpace, so it was a little bit simpler for us as opposed to having to migrate from, I know somebody said Rediscovery this morning, which is miserable. And we are not using the public this way. So that's a little bit of context. We are hosting ourselves. So jump into some challenges to start out. And so the challenges really will help you like understand where your time's gonna go, understand hopefully what you're gonna be spending most time on, and number one is data cleanup. And so that's what I looked like when I first started looking at our data. And so we had, and in some ways still have, very messy data, and I would just stress that it's never gonna be good enough, but you want it as good as possible. Because there are some things that we said, it's good enough, and then we migrate and we're like, now that we wanna be doing more, and I'll get into some of the more bigger opportunities that ArchivesSpace has lent us in the end, we have to go back and do more data cleanup. And you really only wanna have to do that once because it's not fun. But to give an idea, we had like extent types. I'm not gonna go through our entire list of like 22, but we had three different ways of saying box. We had box, boxes, boxes with parentheses around the ES. We had two volumes. One volume was capitalized, one wasn't. And that was just an example of every single controlled value list in our archivist toolkit setting. We also had problems with subjects, duplicated subjects, issues where we had one subject as a topic, once as a geographic term, and once as a local term. And why? I don't know. So you want to get that stuff done. That was probably a good quarter. I have a blog. We have a blog post up on the RAC website that goes breaks out directly exactly how many hours I spent on each section. That was probably a good quarter of the entire time. Besides learning, besides doing testing, it was data cleanup is the biggest problem that you'll face. And once you get a handle of that, and the how you get a handle of that is just getting your database, getting your data into a usable format that you can just play around with, that you can mess with. You don't have to be an expert. MySQL's actually pretty easy to do most of the stuff with. And once you get familiar with that, you're really powerful for what you're doing, what you want to do. You can avoid most data problems by having well-defined standards and documentation for description. And so that's what we've decided to do moving forward. You know, you can't do stuff about you can't do that with your legacy data. We understand things happened 35 years ago when you weren't there, but you can do that. You can make sure going forward you don't have to do data cleanup again when eventually we'll migrate away from archive space, however long that is. And so that leads us to migration testing. So that's kind of how I felt at the first migration. In fact, the first migration didn't work at all. I just had set something up incorrectly in the database. Second migration had only about 130 errors, which, you know, is if you've done the migration testing, that's actually pretty good. I was happy about that. And that's because of the time spent on the data cleanup beforehand. Migration testing is an iterative process, as with everything that I'll talk about. You want to do it 3-4 times with every version. When we started working on this project, I think it was version 1.01, and we finished with 1.12, I think, is what we went live to. So there are a lot of changes. There are a lot of, I don't remember the exact number of releases in between all of those. In the very beginning, migration testing and migration error reporting wasn't great. I got an error, status code 400, bad request, error null. I had no idea what that meant. So you just have to kind of like muddle through, understand what you're doing, test around a little bit. That's why it's really important to have your database, so you can look at exactly what's throwing the error and understand maybe you can see something in the data that's a little bit different, play around a little bit. But iterative testing is by far the most important part of migration testing. The tools for AT to archive space are great. I understand there are still issues with Archon, but just try, get on the listserv when you have questions. Understand your data, and everything will be okay. But sometimes you don't understand everything, and you gotta, when you're trying to fix things yourselves, because errors happen, archive space is still fairly new. It does have some bugs, it's young. And so one of our large challenges was understanding what was going wrong and why. And just the only way that we could do that is test. You gotta test. We have a production server and a development server. So every new release that comes out, we put on our development server and run it through like a rigorous course of testing. Every single functionality that was in the original, we essentially test in the next release. And that takes time. That's ongoing time for as long as you use the system. And That's kind of what you got to do. That's what happens with any software. And so when you're trying to troubleshoot new errors that come up, you have to figure out, it's very helpful for the community and for your own archive to understand why they're happening, document why they're happening. And so that's a lot of times. So every single new release when we were testing, we did this. We did a migration. We don't do migrations to the new releases anymore, but we did a migration before we had gone live into production. We export, we import, we have people play with it on staff that to kind of duplicate what they work, what the type of work they're doing. Sometimes these issues persist, but once you know what they are and what's causing them, it's easier for them to get fixed. And then finally, the big challenge was training. I had never really trained people before, so I had to like think on the fly, and part of training came with writing a whole lot of training documentation. But at the RAC, we have this, we like to call it a user-centric approach to any of the systems that we implement. And so a big part of that is getting your users involved as early in the process as possible. And by helping them understand why you're making the change and what the change will help them do and understanding how they do their work is vastly important to beating that fear that a lot of people have about new things. So we did usability testing with our users. We had one person from each functional group of the archive work with the software to understand, to replicate that the work they were doing at Archivist Toolkit in archive space, tell us where it wasn't working for them and where it was. And then we could develop training based upon that interaction and that feedback to directly relate to what they wanted to do and what we thought would have to change. I spent about 20 hours in training. Total, this is like just specifically training people on the software. And with every single group, we have reference, description, and accessioning, all using it in different ways. Get your documents in order, talk to people, let them see what's good, working well. And then we get into our successes because of this. So we had full data transfer, which was really, that was our one success point. It's sort of a caveat. We had three records that didn't transfer because they were so large. They were probably each about 15 megabytes in EAD. So not quite full, but about 99.9%, and we managed to just put those, break them up and put them in manually, and then rejoin them when they were in the system. So no missing data. That was, if we couldn't get that, we wouldn't have moved. User adoption has been great. There was a quick transition from AT to AS. People complain a little bit, but they will always complain sometimes. But overall, people love it. It's a lot more user-friendly. Also, you know, they were very receptive to not having to have somebody come and install a new version on their computer every time a new version was released, which is really nice. Then the new opportunities. And so what we've been really enjoying from ArchivesSpace, and because we messed around with the implementation, got things, our data in order, is that now we're letting the system do the work a machine should do, whereas we're starting to do work that only humans can do. For instance, my colleague Hillel Arnold recently wrote a series of scripts to automatically export EAD based upon when a resource record is updated. And it only takes ones that are deemed to be published online. And it will export those every night. So anything that was updated in the last 24 hours will get exported. Also, a PDF will get created from that. And it'll automatically get moved to our folder, to a certain folder, and then put up into our XTF collection. And we no longer have to have anybody, when they make a little change to the spelling or correct spelling, email somebody and say, hey, can you export this and put it in this folder, and then have to talk to Hillel and say, this is going up tomorrow. It's really simple. It's really easy. It's nice. The work that Yale's doing on the locations management plugin is going to be really exciting for us. We're also working on integrating with Archivematica to have automatic creation of resource of digital objects, and the work that the Bentley is doing is really exciting to us. So understand that it's an ongoing process, that once you're moved over to ArchivSpace, your work isn't done. But when you get there, it's a lot easier. And the data and migration are the biggest issues. But when you can get there, it'll be exciting. And then there's Mark.
So Patrick, I am instantly really jealous about hearing that you only had 20 plus extent types. That's yeah, pretty small. You should start importing some MARC records. You'll get some crazy ones. Also, yes, the other controlled value stuff. My favorite that I've seen that we've come across since now cleaned up. My favorite archival level of description that we had was rearies, and our favorite instance type I've come across was foddlers for folders. So you'll see why we need to stop spelling. All right, so my talk is going to be divided into two parts. First, I'm going to provide an overview of what we've done so far at Yale to implement ArchivSpace. And second, I'm going to close with five recommendations that I hope you'll find useful, regardless of where you're at in your own process of either evaluating, adopting, or using ArchivSpace in your daily work. Regarding the second part of my talk, I should also mention that even though I'm representing a very large institution with multiple special collections departments, I firmly believe that all of the recommendations that I'm going to offer today can be applied to an organization of any size once it undertakes a metadata migration project or goes about the process of implementing a new piece of software. And the reason that I believe what I just said is due to personal experience. I've previously been responsible for a number of different metadata migrations that were carried out in the process of implementing new software. In each case, the steps and the checklist remained virtually the same, even though the scale of data that needed to be migrated and the sophistication of the software that needed to be implemented were often dramatically different. Additionally, we just heard a very entertaining update from Patrick, who, while it wouldn't be precise to say that he was working entirely on his own, well, yeah, actually, I would say you pretty much were working entirely on your own to do the migration. So if one person can do it, I think anybody can do it. Yale's story involves many different players in significant ways, but our ultimate goal was always the same: to implement a single tool that each of our special collections departments could use to manage their archival workflows. So what exactly put us on the path to trying to adopt just a single tool? I won't start at the very beginning, as is often advised, but I will point back to the month of, March 2013. At that time, a special collections white paper was delivered to Yale University Library. The white paper outlined 8 different challenges that we faced, and it also included recommendations for how to address those challenges. The first recommendation listed in the white paper, which our library continues to refer to and take very seriously, advises that all of Yale's special collections units should use Archivist Toolkit or its planned successor, ArchivSpace, and Aeon to automate and integrate as many collection management tasks as possible. Given this recommendation, it didn't come as a surprise to me for Yale to officially become an ArchivSpace charter member in May 2013, just a few months after the white paper was distributed. Of course, Yale University Library already had close ties with ArchivSpace long before 2013, since Mark Matienzo served as the technical lead of ArchivSpace while the initial development of the software was still being funded by the Mellon Foundation, and even before ArchivSpace, found its organizational home at Lyrisys. The actual act of becoming charter members was nevertheless really important for us as an organization, especially because we joined the ArchivSpace membership community as Yale University, not just Yale University Library, which reinforced the true spirit of the white paper's first recommendation.
But even as newly registered charter members, we still had questions about how we would get to the point that all of Yale's special collections departments would be able to use the same tool to manage their collections. Therefore, shortly after we became charter members, Yale's Special Collections Steering Committee formed a task force to evaluate all of the different tools already in use in its departments and to provide a recommendation as to whether or not we should actually move to archive space as as their single tool or as that single system. That task force, in May of 2015, which is the time that we did our migration, we were able to quickly copy over into archive space all of the usernames and timestamps that were listed in the AT. Which you'll see there at the bottom, it's like, you'll see the timestamp 2012, long before we actually did our migration. This is just one example of the application that we evaluated during the course of our implementation, which may or may not be applicable to your own implementation process. For us, though, it was crucial that we retain this sort of information in our active database, since our accession records document the exact moment that we take physical and legal control over our archival collections. Of course, there are many other aspects of the database and the system that you'll want to evaluate, whether you're still considering archive space, whether you're writing an implementation plan right now, or whether you're already in production. To give you an idea of a few of the other ways that you can evaluate archive space, I'm going to hand things over to Melissa.
A few times today I've heard lyricist staff say hosties, so I don't know if there are any Swifties in the audience that understand my hilarious joke opening slide. Okay, so I'm going to talk today about software performance testing, and I'll give an overview of what that is for those who are less familiar, and I was thinking about how I wanted to measure success for this conversation today, and that is for everybody, to leave here with the confidence that they could go back to their desk and perform these types of tests. You don't need an IT department to do them for you. If they're willing to help out, that's wonderful. Depending on what your relationship is with your either library or campus IT, or if somebody just sort of picks up those jobs because they have a certain capacity, I want people to leave here today knowing that this is all within their reach. So an overview of what software performance testing is. Just think of it as a way to pre-script or pre-record actions that you would typically perform in the application, again, used to simulate user behavior or used to test particular components of the code. And those are then executed either on demand through a timer. You can set them up to run in a cron different times during the day. And what you'll get back is a set of results and measurements that will tell you what's happening both the back end, front end, and all ports in between. Some reasons why you or your organization would want to do software performance testing. Going back to some of what Patrick had said, testing is just part of the process. It's part of the work. You'll do it at different points in your implementation or post-production. But some of the reasons why, again, you could measure peak usage, again, without having to schedule staff time. This is something that we did both of these, where you have to organize, hey, can we get 30 staff for half an hour in the morning, and everybody just pound away at archive space. So sometimes it's possible to do that, but automating that process allows you to simulate that level of usage on your own. I think it provides the opportunity for a little bit more consistent review because it is automated and less likely to be anecdotal. And it's something, again, I think you should be doing pre and post upgrade or release, or if you make any other hardware infrastructure changes as well, you have a measurement before and a measurement afterwards. Also good for capacity planning, both in terms of the amount of data that you would anticipate having or sort of the style of your data, and capacity planning for users as well. And it gives you the opportunity, again, to look at concurrent users accessing or performing critical functions. Concurrent users slightly different from peak usage. It would just be even something like two or three users trying to perform a task at one time. Your peak usage might be you have 50 or more users. And One of the most obvious reasons are your users, are they experiencing poor performance? Let's take a closer look at what might be causing that. So there's a few different types of software performance testing. The most fundamental would be unit or component testing. So you're looking at a discrete part of the code or application. Again, back end, front end, or both together. You could be testing a particular workflow within the application. There's a type of performance testing called smoke testing, which is, again, not peak or stress testing, but just looking at a low load over an extended period of time to see, again, that the application is performing as expected. Peak load testing, again, what you think the maximum or typical maximum number of users would be. Soak testing as well, and what I don't have up here would be like stress testing, which is when is the system going to start to break down completely because you have more activity than what your peak load might normally be. And for what it's worth, don't forget to give it the old eyeball test, like the government says. If you see something, say something, because when you're sitting in front of your workstation trying to use a particular application and it's not performing or you notice something odd, say something. This is also where many non-functional requirements are typically best measured, including data integrity or the general usability of the application. So just to show you one complete set of values for a workflow and the different pieces involved. So for one workflow that we were trying to measure, from the back end, the database end, it took 6 seconds to retrieve a record from the database and produce the JSON representation. And the front end, 16 seconds to produce the HTML. And what the user was experiencing up in front in the browser was over 2 minutes. So again, each piece adding it all up is either acceptable or it becomes a painful experience to use, but breaking it down into these components, that gives you a starting place. The tools that I use to start measuring performance of archive space, they're freely available. There's a lot more to those tools than I took advantage of, but it gives you a place to start, a conversation either with your colleagues, administration, your IT, with Lyricists, with other third parties, whoever it might be. Just, you know, taking a few minutes to do this type of test starts to give you this type of data. And again, depending on the relationship your particular organization has with IT, this will give them a little more information to get started. So 6 seconds in the back end, okay, maybe that seems reasonable. That seems about average. 16 seconds in the front end, maybe some adjusting there. But again, it just gives more data to focus everybody else's additional effort. So I built my scripts this way. I did use JMeter. Again, it's a free desktop tool. You don't need anybody in the IT department to do that for you. Very accessible. So I was given each test I did a particular name. I got from Mark and Maureen and other colleagues what they considered key workflows, things that they wanted, you know, to see performance metrics on. So this is an example of editing and saving an archival object, although I think maybe I'm supposed to say component for that. I'm not sure. So that's a basic thing. JMeter allows you to do some parameters. So I was in our test environment for archive space, and I did two threads. And threads is the equivalent of the number of users. So I had two users. And within 5 seconds, each of those users would initiate this script on the system, and the loop refers to the number of times that you want that test to be executed. So again, all variables, but this would be, for example, either unit testing or smoke testing, just making sure that the system can perform these steps I've outlined there. I got to search for my own name in the database. There was stuff. So this is just, again, all the steps. I wouldn't necessarily include a login every time. I kept doing that just for consistency, but if your user, typically they might log in once in the morning and they have it on for the rest of the day, but just make a note that the login was included in the timings. So I wanted to show you, and I tested this morning. I know it's hard to see clearly in the back and also up front, but it's this will be made available, I think, online. It's okay. Everybody come on down. So I just wanted to give you a sample of what JMeter produces for you. And again, this is what I refer to as the consistency each time you run a test. So this process of editing and saving an archival object, you can get measurements on this. You have a baseline. If you were to make modifications, change something, you run that test again, and you have these consistent points of comparison. In addition to someone saying, yeah, I think that went faster. So here's something you can actually compare. So everything is measured in milliseconds. So each line on this chart represents a different specific function or call that has to happen to make all those seven steps happen, logging in, selecting repository, searching, and so on. So at the 500 line here in the middle, that's half a second. So again, if you add all this up, you can see the back end, it's just only a couple of seconds total end-to-end to get that task completed. So this one's even better, but it gives you another breakdown, another view into what's happening. So each test step, the time of day, how long each one took, the different threads that are happening, and again, all the different calls that are taking place, and sample time, status, the positive, negative, there's latency scores, all this, again, pretty rich, dare I say, metadata to figure out what exactly is happening there. It gives you average, deviations, and so on. So a lot of rich data coming back, explaining just what's happening in the back end as you execute these activities in ArchivesSpace. Here's another thing, if you like, again, color, this is what's here. Again, all the different tasks like we saw in the bar chart represented here on a different type of scale. Okay, so JMeter gave you the opportunity to take a look at what was happening in the back end. Another freely accessible desktop tool that you should be confident to set up and use on your own would be developer tools in Chrome. So I use the same approach. In this case, still the test environment, one manual user, and I wanted to now measure in the front end in the browser that same workflow. So logging in, selecting a repository, searching for my name, finding a record, editing, saving, what have you. And again, I know these are a little difficult to get a good look at, but so this is Chrome. I have a developer pane open, which you can see here. I kept putting testing things so I could go back and clean them out later so I don't make messy data for my colleagues, but we were in test, so checking the record there. So as you are manually going through the steps in the browser, Chrome is recording measurements about how long that each step is taking. So you can see here it gives you just a little over 2 minutes to finish that workflow. Again, sitting in front of the screen, the user's point of view, and how long different things took, like loading the page, rendering, painting, just pulling all that information together up front. So again, these are fairly powerful tools that web developers or software developers would use. I'm not a web developer, so again, I hope to just convey that they're freely accessible, they're easy to use. It gives you, again, a starting place to have a conversation about where to focus your efforts, where improvements can be made if you're noticing performance issues. This was another view in Chrome, and again, I know it's hard to see like this, but again, you have each step of the process. It gives you a status, 200 is good. What's happening, seconds. So again, somebody may want to see that information presented in a different view. Now, throughout the past couple of months, I guess, we've also been working with HM to help troubleshoot our system. So I wanted to show you again the value of doing this type of testing. So they had performed similar tests on our test system. So the top of the screen, bless you, you'll see one thread in our pre-optimized environment. Now, in this case, they did, remember I said thread is the number of users. So they simulated 50 users trying to search and save a record back to our database. So the blue line towards the bottom there represents the select process, and the other line represents saving those records back to the database. It didn't actually change data, they just pressed the save button back. So for 50 users, you can see that peak times were about 7 seconds. Again, these are milliseconds, so if you add up that process end to end, you're about 7 seconds. And this was just in a test environment with the default set, not an optimized environment, recommendations that we had from Chris and other people about how to make sure MySQL was set up correctly. So in the bottom half, you do see that same process, one thread, 50 users, with a basic tuning that we did. And same thing, 50 users, that's an incredible improvement, right? So another you know, reason to do this type of testing is to see if those little tweaks and adjustments you or your IT staff are making are paying off. And in this case, clearly they are. So again, that end user experience or that user-centric approach that you're looking for in your organization, when Mark and I were practicing, I said, oh, 7 seconds, that's not so bad. But he's like, well, wait a minute there. And again, when you realize all the stops it has to make along the way, you want to be pretty tight at each station. So getting it, that, to me, that's a really cool improvement. And some pretty basic changes that we had from Chris at Lyrisys to put in, and look at how much improvement right there. And this is just 10 threads, again, post-optimization. So that's 500 users. And again, it's around 4 seconds. So that's, I mean, 500 would be beyond peak usage. That's really moving into stress test category. So again, you can see, I think here at the bottom, those values, again, in an environment that was optimized, even for 500 users, it's really good. It's really good performance, 4 seconds. Okay. So there are some things, obviously, that would fall outside the scope of this type of measurement. And that is, of course, knowledge of the application. What is it that we're supposed to test? What is the right way to do it? There are some interesting subtleties, too. I had started testing some of the workflows Mark and Maureen gave me, and had different results when I hit the view button as opposed to the edit button, but their typical workflow would be to hit the edit button. So it's important, again, to have that application knowledge. And that will help you develop that specific set of steps that you want to then record in one of the testing tools. And then, again, when you get those results back, someone's going to need to be able to interpret them and say, well, again, few seconds here, that's considered normal web behavior, normal index behavior, or definitely an area where improvement is needed. And what you set for benchmarks for that end user experience, because that's ultimately where you're going to win. People are going to sit down and be happy with the software, not put comment cards in IT's mailbox about what's going on. So you're going to benchmark that user experience. And although it's very similar, they work well in tandem. In some more typical infrastructure monitoring tools like New Relic, which are not free, designed to monitor, again, the infrastructure in a different way, CPU memory, Java heap space, that kind of thing, slow queries. So that's outside the scope of what JMeter and Chrome are doing. A couple other things that are good to ask, good to know. When you're looking at these tools, as I said, I use JMeter, I use Chrome. There are other tools, Selenium. There are tools that you can pay for that do a lot of other fancier things. They can link to bug or incident tracking tools, development tools you have like Jira. Again, it depends on what your needs are, what your budget are. Make sure if you need to, the tool that you select allows you to write scripts in whatever language you or other staff might be comfortable doing, or otherwise it's just a record and capture of the steps you're entering into the browser and then just casting those back out. But you have some of these tools also give you the option to write a Ruby script, for example, if you don't want to do the point and click. Okay. So that's my talk. And I think I'm going to give it back to Mark because he's in charge.
Great. So I don't know how we did it, but we finished exactly on time. So we have 30 minutes for what we've been tooling as our highly interactive Q&A session. So I'm hoping some folks will want to come up to the microphones and ask a question. I wasn't doing email or anything earlier up here. I was trying to follow Twitter because there's been some tweets coming out. So I also want to try to be mindful of the questions that are coming over on Twitter. So also, if anyone notices a question on Twitter that I don't see, feel free to come up and ask a question, you know, be a proxy for somebody. I did see one question come up, and this is, I'm going to kind of generalize it as well, but I'll open it up to the floor first. There's a question for our group here asking if anyone is integrating Archive Space with the Liberty 5 OPAC, and I just did a quick Google for Liberty 5, and it looked to be something Australian. I'm not actually familiar with it. Huh?
That's my question.
Oh, well, do you want to, yeah, okay, so that's your question, great. Can you say your name and Jessica State?
From the Congregational Library and Archive in Boston.
Okay, Jessica from the Congregational Library and Archive in Boston has had the question about the Liberty 5 OPAC. I would also just generalize that as well and ask about if other folks are, looking at other OPAC integrations, because I know that's something Melissa and I, we had definitely been talking about, especially when it comes to doing our BIB and MUFHEAD records. We really want to be able to have Archive Space and our ILS talk to each other in different ways.
So I'm not sure type of integration that you're referring to, because we're talking about making use of the library and the APIs that Exlibris provides for Voyager and using those to batch update or batch create BIB records, holdings records, record level data, and I don't know if that's the type of integration you're referring to. I don't even know. Okay.
It doesn't sound like it is, but yes, I guess just project.
I'll just talk to you. So we have a lot of data that was in an old database, migrated into 18, but we have a tremendous amount of archival metadata that was never in anything that, comprised an archival metadata system. So we have a lot that's in MARC that we're looking to get in, so it's just a topic we're interested in.
Yeah, I just wrote an SSLC biotech that works with
say that with Nicole from Michigan State?
Yeah.
Okay, great. And I would just encourage you also to post that to the listserv when you're, because it was just,
cool.
Sounds good. Yeah, come on.
Worked out, but I think are really important ones. And the scoring
Great. Yeah, so item records is a really interesting topic. I don't know if everyone in the audience knows what item records are or why, you know, archival institutions often use them. But, they're another record in an ILS where you can basically put a, stick a barcode, a box identifier, and say, like, this is how I'm going to, manage this box. So it's generally used, I think, for serials and other things, but we often now have been using them for box records. The one thing I would say about that, we're still currently putting in item records into our ILS, and we're also having our Aon system query archive space now as well to just get that same type of item information, and that's really something that really went into the container management plugin for archive space, because eventually we want to stop having to create item records in our ILS, because we're adding all of that data to archive space anyway. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
Okay, if you're talking about sort of a sandbox environment.
Sandbox, but they're actually getting a sandbox.
Yeah. In fact, we've talked to a couple of clients who do have more data about how to get a full set of the data into our sandbox. But we're not as deep into, we don't have a large number of large clients. So we do have a sandbox environment. We put the new version on and shake it down. It's coming to the community. Embedded already. And within the scope of that test, we'll launch a service. So I'm a little bit handicapped because I'm sort of new to the organization. We've only been through maybe one migration, I think, since I've come on. But I can meet you after. I can get your contact. I'll get you a better answer.
Yeah, I guess my point is not about small organization or a
large. Yeah, right. I just want to add a couple things to that. We're not in a hosted environment, so I can't speak to that. I mean, we have actually looked at hosted options, though. So we're currently hosting ourselves, and we've set our archive space implementation up into three instances. We have a development instance, which pretty much goes untested, but we've kind of been using it as a double test instance. We have a test instance, which is another place that we really want to make sure anytime we do upgrades, plugins, et cetera, or even updating Java or something else, we go through there first. And then we have our production instance, which is basically, locked down, hands off, try not to do any darn thing to it until we're good and, good and ready for those kinds of things. So I think those are great questions for how do you do that in the hosted environment. One way I'll just, and this is not a great recommendation, but one of the things I really like about the Archive Space application, it's so easy to run off of, anyone's laptop. Essentially, you could probably run, I think, Chris, you mentioned running off a netbook this morning. Our database size at Yale for production is about 4 gigs, which I don't think is terribly large. The solar index becomes much larger, about, 20 gigs or so, but still, as long as you have that disk space, it's really easy to run on your own laptop, and you could, not a great solution, but I would still recommend any kind of testing to, if you can do it on your own as well, I would give it a shot. But that's a good question. Patrick, I don't know how are you guys handling it at the Rockefeller? Do you have multiple instances, or do you just have?
We have technically three, I guess. One is the dev, which actually does most. We do most of our testing on. One is the production that no one gets to touch, and I'm the only one with access to that server. And then I actually have my own personal instance that I run on my computer. So if I want to do testing on code that or plugins that we're developing, or just working something faster, working on the database and trying out database tests or trying to change things, I don't have to redo the dev database if I make a mistake. I can just load it up into my local computer, and that's nice. But I think actually we probably have more. I think Hillel, my colleague, has his own copy of the database on his computer too that he works with. So.
Yeah, so Chris was talking about the New Relic plugin. I think we have a I think we have an account for a different. Yeah, for a different service, but it's packaged in every archive space release. And as you mentioned, or I don't know if you mentioned, but the README file is also updated to how to even just install it and turn it on, or basically just turning it on. And that's in the plugin architecture. All right, checking Twitter again, but I don't think I. Oh, yeah, sure.
Migrate to a full database, and you include
seen a question from Jessica asking, just a raise of hand if folks who are actually, I love this new word, I've never heard it, hosties with Lyricists. So I see, and can you say your institution as well? So that's, I already knew that, but I was going to make you say it. Grand Valley, Congregational Library and Archive, and Berea College. Anyone else? Yeah, you guys should talk. But oh, yeah, if you're not already. And I think there was a question in the back as well. That's a great question. So to repeat it, if I don't know if everyone heard, is anyone looking at metadata harvesting out of archive space, whether into something like EBSCOhost, Summon, say GitHub, which you already mentioned that, so that's a good one. But any other kind of tools like that? And Adam, that's the access to memory, which is okay. Interesting. So you'd right. Okay. I don't know about Patrick. Do you guys have any other? Your XTF is what you're.
Yeah, we're also. Going to in the next month probably put all of our mining aids in GitHub.
Yeah.
We're looking into DAMs, and we want there'll probably be some integration between archive space and the DAM, specifically with some premise or mons information that we'd like to work out that workflow, but we're still early in that process.
Right. And so at Yale, we've been, the library IT department over the past year has been bringing up Quick Search, which right now I think all it is a merger of two different ILSs, the Law Library's catalog as well as the Yale Library's catalog. I assume at some point they're going to start knocking on some doors asking about other data that they could get in, saying, I mean, we have the MARC records, but not the long tail of the description. Mm-hmm. So that was something we have on our like to-do list, but we haven't tackled that yet from archive space to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so there's been one of the breakout sessions later this afternoon I think is going to start looking at, I think the integration opportunities are kind of endless. I mean, archive space, one of the things we love about it is that it's, built with this API first mentality, and the API is like the application programming interface, such that, essentially anything a user can do, you can basically start writing programs against and having system integration. The other big system integration we're going to be looking at, this, again, this doesn't actually answer your question about the searching tools like EBSCOhost and Summon, but like folks at Michigan and others looking at Archivematica, we're going to have to start looking at doing some Preservica integrations as well for our digital preservation system. So I think, there's going to be many flowers blooming in terms of archive space integrations over the next 5 years. I see another question on Twitter from Noah asking about how folks at this point view archive space as the system of record for all archival metadata or maybe just some, and what about item records and digital objects?
A lot of that, the actual system, or
chime in a little bit for Yale's perspective. We are aiming to have Archive Space be the digital record for all of our archival metadata. At this point, we're not there yet. One of the things that's keeping us from that is the MARC records. So in the migration, you know, AT didn't have the data model to actually do, you know, subject heading, subfield, et cetera. So we have to still clean up our subject records, our agent records, and we don't have the ability to push out from Archive Space into our ILS or into WorldCat, which, you know, we really want to be able to retain those things. So until we have that and we have, you know, cleaned up some of that data in Archive Space, we won't be seeing it as that authoritative record. I also mentioned the item records earlier. In the process of even adopting Archivist Toolkit, we undertook the process of trying to start to merge some of our item records with our EAD description, and this was a great opportunity. I'm seeing Brad smiling, but this was a great opportunity because, I mean, anytime you're doing some kind of reconciliation project, basically, you fix a lot of errors. So one of the problems with us having our item records in a separate system from our archival description is that we very often had finding aids that would describe 100 boxes, and then you go to our ILS or Voyager catalog, and we might have item records for 99. There's nothing telling the archivist that, hey, this is completely finished, this is done. It's really dependent on that, you know, the set of eyes check that Melissa mentioned before, and that often just gets lost because people have to go to a meeting, something comes up, the box goes to preservation and doesn't come back for 5 years. That's not a dig against preservation. But those things happen, and it's so having it all in the same system and being able to say Archive Space is our system of record for not only just the archival description, but our container management stuff, our, you know, the MARC record, you know, the ability to push the MARC records, I think that'd be huge. We're not there yet, definitely. And yeah, so we also, yeah, so we, sorry, I mentioned, you know, we were finding those differences. We were able to merge barcodes into our EAD finding aids, but we didn't have a place to put that restriction information and other things until we work on that container management plugin with Hudson Milonglo. So once we get all of that data from our ILS into Archive Space, that'll be huge for us. The other thing is the digital objects. I think we bit off a lot in our 18 months or so. So there's a lot of things we postponed. We postponed the public interface. We postponed digital objects. We postponed really considering how we're going to do events and collection management in Archive Space. And postponing digital objects, what we're thinking now is that we would like to use it to manage links between other systems, but not to have it be the system of record for digital object description. That's just our thinking right now. We haven't made final plans for that.